Good morning, everybody, and hello to my fellow Earthlings. Welcome to another episode of The Considered Life, the podcast about claiming back life ownership and leading an intentional, reflected, and sustainable life. It's a beautiful, rainy, gray Wednesday morning here in Switzerland. This is Mark. I'm your host on your Considered Life journey. And now, without any further ado, nor any advertising, let's just jump into it. I hope you enjoy. He lost his father in a tragic accident when he was 13 and was accused of being responsible for this tragic death. Following years of trauma and abuse, he lived through the darkness of drug and alcohol addiction. He was diagnosed with type 2 bipolar disorder. He decided to change his life for the better after attending a funeral together with his AA sponsor, went through recovery, and is now sober for more than 13 years. He is happily married to that woman that accompanied him through the darkness and never ever gave up on him. He's a 12 times Ironman finisher, successfully ran 7 long distance races of 100 miles. He decided to document his story from being an addict to being a successful triathlete in a book called Tripolar, the Story of a Bipolar Athlete. Now join me in welcoming Tim Davis, the Tripolar Athlete. Hey Tim, good to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Very welcome. I have read your book, obviously, Tripolar, the Story of a Bipolar Athlete. And it starts with a very shocking story, right? When you were 13, your dad died in an accident. And subsequently, you lived through a period of trauma, childhood abuse, and even being blamed for your father's death, right? Can you explain us what happened and how did you overcome these terrible times?
Sure. So when I was 13, you know, when the accident happened, you know, me and my sister were just playing with my dad. We were tickling each other and playing chase. And my dad had been drinking all day. It was a Saturday. He drank a lot on the weekends. And my older brother and sister were off to work at their McDonald's jobs. But anyway, he was chasing me. We ran out to the balcony and I ran down the balcony and back in the other entrance into the house. And he tripped and did not make the right turn back into the house. And he fell, you know, end over and landed head first on a, you know, off a second story balcony down on our driveway below. And it was a really crazy night. You know, my mom went into panic mode and my sister went into panic mode. We were all kind of, you know, shocked. And my mom went off to the hospital with him. He ended up being in a coma for 8 months before he died. But the night of the accident, when my brother came home late that night, because he went to the hospital after he got off work, you know, he was the one who proceeded to yank me out of my bed around 2 or 3 in the morning and physically beat me up for over an hour, you know, just slammed me into every wall in the room, my bedroom, and kept punching on my everywhere except for my face, because he would never punch me in the face because then my parents would know. But, you know, my arms, my chest, my legs, kicking me and stomping on me, all kinds of stuff. And I was just curled up in the fetal position, you know, kind of, you know, just praying to God that this would end soon and just traumatized. You know, and he was blaming me that it was my fault. Our dad was going to die. You know, and he told me that, you know, with a lot of expletives, you know, like, you effing killed dad. It's your fault. He's going to die. Because, you know, at the hospital, they told us that he had broken his first 4 cervical vertebrae. And if you break C1 and C2, you're basically brain dead. So that was not good. So my mom held out hope that he might come out of the coma, but even the doctors were like, if he never come out, he's going to have to be on the full-term life support machine and his brain's not going to function. So that was rough. And, that's kind of, it took me a long time to realize that it wasn't my fault that he died. You know, at age 13, with all that going on, I was just a kid. I didn't know any better. I really thought it was my fault. And I carried that cross with me for a long time. And it led me into, you know, using drugs and alcohol to kind of cope, because my mom never sought to get therapy for any of us. I mean, this was in the late 80s. And I guess therapy and mental health was not as widely promoted or in a positive manner the way it is, you know, looked upon more now that we know more. So, that was a rough journey. And it wasn't until after college and when I tried to get sober after, you know, years of kind of drowning that out with drugs and alcohol that I really dealt with it and went through therapy for 4 or 5 years to process it. And I really came to terms with the fact that it wasn't my fault. I was just a kid, you know, accidents happen, that it was just an accident. And it took a lot of 12-step work and therapy work to really come to terms and get over that.
Terrible times. I'm really still having literally tears in my eyes hearing that story, Tim. Yeah. And you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder, right? Can you tell us a little bit more about what it is about and what your specific type of bipolar disorder is?
Yes. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder at age 27 after getting out of like my third rehab and just really being mentally unstable. I was having anxiety attacks. And I was struggling with periods of depression. I'm a type 2 bipolar disorder, a rapid cycler. The type 1 is kind of like the severe manic depressive and just more severe than the type 2. So I'm grateful I'm not a type 1, but still being a type 2 is tough because as a rapid cycler, you know, I can go through periods of really good moods and really low moods all in the course of a day. I'm on regular mood stabilizers now, which help, but it's not the only thing that helps me stay stable and in recovery. I think, you know, there's not a lot of research about bipolar disorder. You know, I believe it's genetic, but I think there's also nature and nurture that causes it. And I know for me, as I look back and reflect, I was always this anxious kid from as early as I can remember, self-conscious and worried about what my peers thought about me ever since I started school, even in kindergarten. But I kind of think that traumatic accident, you know, at age 13 might have also kind of ignited sort of a bipolar split, and definitely the drug use, you know, really excelled it later in my 20s.
And then you had this long story about addiction, being sober, relapsing, being sober again, and so on. And then finally, you found your kind of therapy, not just in psychotherapy, but also in triathlon, in running ultramarathons, and so on. And you also wrote a book about that. It's called Tripolar, The Story of a Bipolar Triathlete. So what triggered the desire in you to write a book about your story and your recovery?
Initially, I think it was during a triathlon I was doing in 2015. And actually, it was with several conversations I had with people here and there. Whenever I didn't talk about the story about my dad's death very often, but you know, when I did talk about it with different people, there were quite a few who suggested, you know, that's a crazy story. You know, maybe you should, you know, write a book about it. You know, and during 2015, I met this guy, Wayne Kurtz, who's an amazing ultra triathlete. And he, you know, we were kind of in the middle of the race and we were running some miles together and I was telling the story and he's like, man, you should write a book. And that's when I really, really thought about trying to write a book about, you know, what had happened to me, what I've gone through and where I'm at now. So maybe other people who have dealt with trauma and child abuse or addiction, alcoholism, could hear this story and hopefully get some hope and inspiration from it, because I'm doing way better now that I, you know, have a stable recovery program and a regular exercise routine. And I'm a functional member of society again. In my 20s, I kind of went in and out of several different jobs when I couldn't stay sober. I really never stayed at the same workplace for more than 2 years. But after I got sober in 2007, I've been with the same employer for the last 13 years now. So, and that feels good to be stable, holding the same steady job, you know, because in my 20s, I just thought that was never going to happen. And I get depressed about that. You know, it was my 20s were some dark years.
Yeah. And that was a long journey for you with so many relapses and being sober for a week to a couple of months and then falling back into it, right?
Yeah. I like to say that I'm a quick study, but a slow learner.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess that addiction is a slow process, right? Generally.
And generally, yeah.
I've been there twice in my life with alcohol, not really being addicted, but, you know, at a point where, you know, like around noontime when things pop up in my head, now a beer would be great. You know, that's for me, it's a warm sign. And that's basically when I stopped totally to consume any alcohol. But generally, it's a slow process. How was that, you know, like coming about with you? How did it start altogether?
How did it start out with me? Well, I was 8 years old when I had my first drink. I had an older brother. He was 4 years older than me. So he was in middle school or junior high, whatever you would call it over there. He was getting into stuff, and I was his next youngest brother, so he just let me do what he was doing. And yeah, I wanted to be cool like the older kids, and I didn't know any better. So, you know, and I did know that, like, once I took that first drink, it made me feel better, because I was always kind of an anxious, insecure kid, and just like nervous and worried about what other kids thought about me. But when I drank and then started smoking weed shortly after that, I just didn't care. You know, I felt confident, and, you know, like, I didn't really care what people thought about me. I just felt like I could do anything. And so I sought to get drunk and high quite a bit. You know, obviously as a young child, I wasn't doing it every day. It progressed as I got older. And it wasn't until I was 25 when I really first thought about getting sober, when my wife was pregnant with that first kid. I was like, oh crap, I got some real responsibilities coming now. I got to try and do something about this. But then it took another 5 years before I kind of really got a handle on it. There were 5 years there where I might get 30 days, or I might get 90 days, or I might even get the 6 month chip, you know, and I was going in and out of meetings and rehabs. But then even one time I got a year, but then 10 days after I got a year sober, I thought I could have one drink, which, you know, turned into like a 3 month relapse. So it took me a while to really hit bottom. I kind of hit a bunch of bottoms until I finally really got sick and tired of being sick and tired, as they say.
From what you've write in the book, that's so true.
Yeah.
So, a long, dark time. So, Tim, reading that book, I think that anyone suffering from bipolar disease or bipolar disorder and any sort of addiction should definitely read that. I think it's a really very valuable resource. But besides that, it's a great book also to understand these diseases, and it could certainly also help people who are codependent, right? And who want to support their partner, a family member, or a friend.
Yes, I have a chapter 5 or 6 is basically called Mariah, which is my wife's name, and she's a codependent, and she goes to Al-Anon, and she's a big part of my story. She stood by me through thick and thin, and she's actually recommended to some of her Al-Anon sponsees, and they've read it, and it's been very helpful for them. Definitely, I think, helpful for not only people who suffer with it, but for family members of people who suffer with mental health issues or addictions.
Yeah, there was this long period when I was reading your book, and Mariah was mentioned the first time. And I thought, like, it's 1 times, 2 times, 3 times, Tim is relapsing and behaving like... I don't say it here, but, you know, I just figured she would at one point be so sick and tired with you that at one point in the book there should be another woman. But no, she's stuck with you. She's still sticking with you. You're happily married. You've got kids. And that's amazing, amazing woman. I think very glad person to have you with.
Yeah, I am lucky and blessed. She's definitely my better half. There were a few times when she came pretty close to leaving me. But she had even asked her sponsor in Al-Anon, you know, she wanted to leave, and she, you know, sponsors kind of give you advice and direction on how to work your program. And her sponsor advised her to hang on, wait for the miracle to happen. And I'm so glad that her sponsor did that, you know, because eventually, you know, a couple of years later, it did happen. I finally got sober, and things have been much better ever since. And she's glad, you know, she's grateful she waited around, you know, and now we've been together 27 years.
That's great. 27 years. I've heard it obviously, but for our listeners, what happened that made you actually really go to stop and become sober for the very last time? And that time that lasts now.
Yeah. Well, there were a couple things. When I was like 27 or 28, I had I was up for a week on methamphetamine, and then I was driving with my little brother, and we were high. I was 27, he was 16, and I crashed the car, and, he didn't have a seatbelt on, and his head went through the windshield, and he kind of got a broken nose and a black eye. And, that was the first time when I realized that what I was doing could hurt somebody else. So I immediately checked into rehab after that and stayed sober for like 6 months. And then the other thing was, after my last relapse, you know, I had kind of been homeless, living out of my car for a couple of months, because my wife said, you know, if you can't stay sober, you can't live here. So, you know, nobody else really wanted me around at the time because I was a mess. I couldn't stay employed. I kept losing job after job. And I ended up, you know, finally checking into rehab again. And my sponsor at the time, he took me to a funeral. And the guy there had 15 years sober, but then he relapsed and died a week later. And then he took me back to my sober living house and he's like, you know, but for the grace of God, there go I, you know, we have a disease that wants to kill us. You know, alcoholism is fatal. It kills a lot of people. Most people don't get sober. And then he told me to look around at all the other guys in the rehab with me. And he's like, all those guys are just a bunch of dead men walking. And he's like, you know what? You can die from this disease too. And your wife and your kids will be sad, but they'll move on. She'll find another man to replace you and to be the father to your children. And kind of when he laid all that on me, out on me, and when I realized that this disease could kill me and that I did not want anybody to replace, you know, me being the husband to my wife and the father to my children, you know, and I didn't want to do the same thing to my kids because my dad died from, you know, an alcoholic related accident when I was 13. So all of that just like motivated me to like, okay, God, please help me. You know, I'm really going to try and do all 12 steps and really do all 12 steps. And that was like it when I had that awareness.
Yeah. I guess sometimes it really takes us to, you know, like really being confronted with our own death. So like really literally, I mean, we all know that one day is going to be the last one, right? But it's so far out. And even, you know, like I was a smoker for many, many, many years. I started when I was 12 years old for life circumstances. I needed to be the cool kid on the block, right? So I, you know, like cigarette was that thing, right? So there's kind of similarity, but then I didn't do the hard drug stuff and so on and so on. But, you know, as a smoker, you know that you're increasing your risk of lung cancer and all that. But, you know, when it comes to stop, the consequence of your actions is so far out in the future that you actually discount that, right? So that funeral and that speech, so to say, of your sponsor at the time, that really was triggering your mindset change, right?
Yes, definitely.
And what would you say what made, you know, like becoming sober again is one of those processes, right? You're stuck into your habits, you're stuck into the and into the highs that the stuff is giving you. What would you say about, you know, like getting out of there? What are the key things that helped you really get out of there?
Well, aside from going to 12-step meetings every day for about the first 5 years of my sobriety, working the 12 steps and, you know, seeing my psychiatrist regularly, I would say exercise. That's kind of like my mission statement for writing this book is that, you know, regular exercise is critical for maintaining good mental health. Because I know for me, if I go more than a couple of days without doing some sort of exercise, I just feel like cranky and restless and irritable. And I just, you know, just my mood is not in a good place. But if I just go even do 30 minutes of cardio on a bike or a run or swim, then I feel better and my mood's lifted. You know, the hormones are released and I feel normal again.
Yeah. I can so correlate with that. I'm doing lots of sports normally as well. I'm not a triathlete, but, you know, like doing weightlifting and stuff like that.
It doesn't matter what sport it is, as long as you're doing something to kind of get your muscles moving and get your blood flowing, you know?
And go out. Yeah, exactly. So what drove you into this infernal triathletism, triathlon?
Well, I like that word. Triathletism. I think that's a new one. I like that. I might use that. What drove me into it? Well, when I was a year and a half sober, you know, like in my first year of sobriety, basically my sponsor, my therapist, all my friends in the 12-step meetings were like, don't worry about what you eat, you know, just stay sober, stay off the drugs and alcohol. So I basically ate like a pig because I'm kind of a food addict too. And I ended up gaining like 60 pounds in my first year sober. And then when I was a year and a half sober, you know, I'm only 5'9" and I hated being over 200 pounds, you know, and I was around 200 for a long time. But then when I stepped on the scale and it said 250, I remember that was December 31st, 2008. It was New Year's Eve of 2009. I was just like, whoa, this rounds up to 300. I'm like, I don't want to go that way. And I made a New Year's resolution to stop eating seconds, to start going to the gym or exercising every day. And then I had a rule. I wasn't allowed to watch TV or play video games until I did my exercise every day. Because, you know, before it, during a year and a half, when I wasn't going to meetings and I wasn't working, I was just sitting on the couch playing video games or watching TV, you know, and it's just a couch potato. So I made a commitment. You can't chill out on the couch till you've done your workout first. So.
And what did you, I mean, okay, that sounds like a New Year's resolution, right? And you do it for a week and then you basically fall off the wagon and, you know, like everything is gone. So what's helping you to actually stay with it?
I really let my anger like just channel this drive to like not be fat anymore. Cause you know, I was depressed because I was overweight and I was angry and I just didn't like who I was. I didn't like, you know, I had a negative self-image. So trying to, you know, just keep my eye on the prize and know that if I just keep doing a little bit every day, gradually it'll come off, you know, and little by little, you know, 4 months later, I lost 40 pounds. 6 months later, I lost it all. And I was back to running half marathons again because I had run a few marathons in college. But then, you know, when I got out of college, you know, I got away from all that stuff with drinking and using and having kids. But then I got back into it and I just, I don't know, I just had a passion for it. You know, I tried a triathlon a few months later and I was like, I did way better than I thought I would. You know, I mean, probably really not that good in the grand scheme of things, but you know, I got 16th in my age division, which I thought was amazing because I thought I was going to get last place. So, I was like, if I really tried this stuff, I can get better. So I just like, you know, ended up buying the gear and, you know, cause like the first triathlon I went to, I had this old rusty mountain bike and I was wearing basketball shorts cause I was a basketball player for years and I just had a cracked helmet and all these other guys are in there and they're like, they got these tight aero bars and these helmets, you know, and they're like the Oakley glasses and the skin tight suits. Yeah. And I'm like, geez, look at all these freaks.
Yeah.
Little did I know a few months later, I was going to be dressing just like those guys.
Yeah, exactly. You have to, right? So it's basically having that, you know, like two things that you basically said. One is to get away from who you were, right?
Yeah.
You said you were sick and tired of being fat, of being untrained and all that. And then to have that picture of yourself. To be as you have been before, like being able to run a half marathon or a marathon. So these two things actually, right? The combination of the two, the away from...
I wanted to get back in shape and fit into my high school clothes again. Because, you know, in high school, I played a lot of sports. And in college, I ran the marathons and played a lot of basketball. And actually, at that time, I had to stop playing basketball because I was 35 and my knees were just... couldn't handle all the twisting and turning anymore. I can jog great, but I just can't, you know, in basketball, you got to stop fast. You got to turn right fast. And I just like, I've had two knee surgeries and my knees just don't do that very well anymore. And it hurts a lot. So I kind of retired from basketball at age 35. And now I just stick to these, you know, less high impact sports, I guess.
Like running up the triathlon,
running, swimming, biking, you know, some people say running's heavy impact, but you know, if you're just jogging in a straight line.
So the considered life is about how to lead a considered life. And my definition of a considered life is a life that is intentional, that is reflected, and that is sustainable, as opposed to just drifting along, just doing whatever you like and regretting what you did afterwards, because that happens to all of us. Right? And also what I found, many of the so-called performance coaches, they are teaching people or they are coaching people into going at maximum speed all day long, right?
Yeah.
And that's not sustainable. So one of my principles is like, surprisingly, I'm a performance coach as well, but surprisingly, like be kind to yourself. Don't overdo it. Right, because that is going to lead into trouble. Right, so if you if you have a predisposition to seek a high in order to compensate, you know, like too much work or a bad mood or anger that you have because you're too stressed or whatever, then you are at least at risk to drop off. Right, or I have many people going into a burnout without noticing. Right, because you're just doing too much, and then maybe you're running a marathon, and then you're so high from running a marathon that you run like immediately continue the second, third, and fourth one without stop, and then you just like fall dead, and that's kind of a burnout phenomenon, right? That's why
I can relate with that. I'm an exercise addict now, and I have pushed my body to some extremes, but I have also kind of suffered from what's called overtraining syndrome.
Yeah.
From pushing my body too hard, where I've had to kind of, my cortisol levels in my kidney were so low that I basically had to take 2 weeks to 2 months off of just really laying low to let things recharge. So, I don't encourage that and I wouldn't promote that on your podcast because I often say one of the most elusive things in life to do is to achieve balance. But for me, I do believe I've achieved a balance between what I call the connection between the mind, body, and spirit, you know. And for me, taking care of my mind is I meditate every day and I listen to what my psychiatrist says. Taking care of the spirit for me is the spiritual connection I get from going to 12-step meetings and working the 12 steps, because that's like my church for me. and running in nature, because I feel like I'm connected with God when I'm trail running is my favorite thing to do. So I just love being out in the local mountains and trails. And that's the third thing I do is regular exercise, but maybe not as much exercise as I do, but I just encourage people to do some form of regular exercise, even if it's just walking around the block a few times, you know, just something where you get your body moving a little bit every day.
That's right.
Because so many of us just have sedentary jobs where we sit in a desk all day. You know, you got to get up, stretch, and move around a little bit. Your body needs that, and your mind needs it.
So it's about, and that's very good what you said. It's like the connection between mind, spirit, and soul, right? To have this connection, the balance. And one thing that didn't come out in the book, actually, you're meditating every day.
Yeah, that's just something I really started doing in the last year or two. I've kind of felt like I was meditating when I was running and training, but now I actually do sit still meditation.
Okay.
Because I have different people who argue about ways you can meditate. Some people think you can meditate while you exercise. Some people don't. But my kind of spiritual guru has encouraged me to do sitting still meditation because I, being the bipolar person, I have a lot of hypomania. So I kind of, when I'm up, you know, and so that's to try and kind of help me slow down.
When you were doing that for the past year or so, what's the change that you actually notice?
I notice actually more peace, just more inner peace. Like things that used to bother me, like when I'm driving on the freeway and somebody cuts me off.
Yeah.
Before I used to get mad. I mean, when I was younger, I used to get mad and flip them off. And then I used to just smile and wave like a smartass. But now I'm just like, whatever, they're in more of a hurry. I'd rather be safe. You go ahead and get in front of me if that's what you need, you know? So I just noticed like more patience and tolerance. And with my kids too, I have three kids and they're 21, 19, and 8. And, you know, it's funny, the 21-year-old and 8-year-old, sometimes they get along great, you know, but then sometimes they fight like they're, you know, like siblings fight. I take deep breaths and I know that, you know, a lot of times they can work it out themselves, you know, and sometimes I need to intervene, but, you know, I'm more relaxed about all of it, you know, I just like, you know, this too shall pass. So
it sounds like you're more centered, right? You're more connected also to yourself.
Yeah. And then I feel like that can help me be of better service to other people around me too. Because, you know, I can be the voice of calm and reason in the face of a storm, even if it's just a little storm.
Sometimes a little storm can be perceived as a large one, right? So
yeah, for the little persons, yeah.
Let's come back to the balance between mind, body, and spirit for a moment, because that seems really important to you. Can you tell us more about that?
I'm like a big promoter of trying to take care of your mind, body, and spirit. It wasn't until I learned how to do those things in conjunction or cohesion with each other that I kind of became steadily stable and sane in my sobriety and recovery. And, you know, that's kind of why I call the book Tripolar, because you've got to take care of the mind, body, and spirit. I really like Trinities, you know, three, the holy number. I like triathlons, you swim, bike, run. And for me, to take care of my mind, I see my psychiatrist regularly. Early on, it was like every week or 2 weeks, you know, and then it was every month. And now it's just, I have a quarterly checkup because I've been stable 13 years. So that's part of taking care of my mind and just staying educated about mental health issues. Taking care of my spirit for me is working my 12-step programs because that's like going to church for me. And also getting out in nature, which is also the third part, taking care of my body, regular exercise every day, at least 30 to 60 minutes of something, you know, and obviously as an endurance athlete, quite a bit more than that on the weekends and some other training sessions. But being out in nature, I feel like I'm connected with God there. So it's not only taking care of my body by running and hiking in the mountains, but it's also, you know, taking care of my spirit by just feeling like I'm out there connected with God and Mother Nature.
And for you, this has contributed a big part to your recovery from addiction as well, right?
Yeah, that is correct. I don't think I could stay sober and recover without being able to do some form of exercise, you know, because the mood stabilizers weren't enough. Like I still had some anxiety and manic thoughts, you know, racing thoughts. That's bipolar people we have, you know, especially when we're in manic episodes, we can talk a mile a minute. It sounds like we're on drugs, but we're not. So, you know, taking the stabilizer slows it down some, but the regular exercise really helps kind of keep me, I guess, even and normal. My wife can tell if I've gone more than 2 days without doing some exercise. She's like, you're really cranky and restless and irritable and discontent. You need to go work out. So So
go have a run for the and then come back.
Like, yeah, go do your little 5 mile run. I have this thing when I'm lazy and I don't feel like working out, I've got to at least do 5 miles or it doesn't count. So she's like, go do your 5 miles at least. So
yeah. So the mind, body, spirit connection is really important. And I think I see that when dealing with people in my coaching practice as well, right? Typically people are coming with any issue around, you know, like mainly professional performance. When they are stuck in the workplace on specific topics. But then when it goes a little bit deeper, we always come to this trinity, as you say, between there is not just a work issue. It also has this systemic connection to, you know, the personal life. And then when you try to work with them through the process of remediating, you always come to the point where, okay, what's your nutrition like? What's your lifestyle like? Are you meditating? Do you taking care of your mind, of your spirit? So, you know, it's really, really important.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned meditation too. I try to do it for at least 10 minutes a day, sometimes more, sometimes less. Sometimes, you know, more than once, you know, I'll just do a few minutes here and there when there's time, you know, because we live busy lives and I got 3 kids. So sometimes it's just sitting in the car for a couple of minutes, taking some deep breaths.
Yeah.
Wherever I can fit it in, though.
That helps the breath to bring down the sympathetic nervous system.
Yeah. And for me, that helped calm down my anxiety, which I still get, you know, being bipolar, it just kicks up a lot. And just sometimes I have no idea what causes it. It's just.
And it's just like, is triggered by no particular thing, right? It just pops up in your body and it's there. And then you have to deal with it, right?
Yeah. And so it's either, you know, the quickest thing I can do is, you know, do some deep breaths or, you know, or go exercise, which really helps, you know, kind of reduce my anxiety. Because then after I get a workout in, it feels like it kind of goes away or at least slows down. So,
yeah. What would you say are, you know, like average Joe wants to go into triathlon or into longer distance running? What would be your recommendations for a person like me, for example, not a big runner?
I guess my recommendation for anybody is to first and foremost, start where you're at. So, for an average Joe, I don't know what kind of other exercise they may do. Maybe they don't run at all. Maybe they play racquetball, basketball, or hike, or who knows what sport they're into. But if you want to get into triathlon, you know, start out with the small steps, sprint triathlons, or, you know, running 5Ks, short distance races, and then, you know, train for that, 1 mile at a time, and then build your way up from there. That's kind of what I had to do in 2009 when I was really overweight and before I really got into the fitness aspect of my recovery. Because I used to weigh 250 pounds back at the beginning of 2009, and then I lost 60 pounds in 6 months. But I started out that first week by just trying to run a mile, and it took me 12 minutes, and I was pretty depressed and angry because in high school, the mile was my event and I used to run it under 5 minutes, but I was like, okay, this is where I'm at. You know, I'm just going to keep running 1 mile every day. And, you know, eventually I'll get faster. The weight will come off, you know, and, you know, cause I also seriously modified my eating habits too, cause I had some horrible eating habits when I first got sober. So those were all big components. And eventually, you know, 6 months later, I'm running a half marathon in under 2 hours, you know, so, but it doesn't, I didn't go to running a half marathon that first day at 250 pounds. I mean, maybe I could have crawled my way through it in 4 or 5 hours. But
and I think that's a very important message here to give to anybody who wants to implement whatever change, right? Whether you are starting to run long distances or starting to sport, whatever sport you're doing, it's just start where you are. It's not like don't compare yourself with, I don't know, the Olympic runners and don't compare yourself with Tim Davis because, you know, like he is at a total different level. But it's like, what's your level today? And then evolve it from there. Take one step after the other and compare yourself to yourself of yesterday and improve step by step, right?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, unless you're a professional athlete, you don't need to compare yourself to anybody. And for me as an amateur triathlete and endurance runner for many years, in my 30s, when I really got into it, you know, I didn't really compare myself to other people, but I just looked at my own times, you know, and the only person I had to beat was myself or my previous best time, you know, and I chased personal records for a long time. Now in my mid to late 40s, I'm not getting any faster. So now I'm just kind of out there having fun, which is actually more relaxing because I just go out there, do the race and get the finish line, get my medal. And it's like, I'm good to go, you know, and some of the races I do are really long. So just finishing is a battle in itself.
You're doing those ultra triathlons as well and Badwater and all this crazy stuff.
I would like to do Badwater. It's got an expensive race fee and they only take 100 entrants every year. But it is on my radar. I have done the Angeles Crest 100-mile endurance run twice and the Kodiak 100-mile endurance run. And I'm actually signed up for the Tahoe 200-mile endurance run next September, which will be my first attempt at that long of a distance, trying to run 200 miles in 4.5 days.
In
the mountains.
You still have close to a year to prepare, right? So that's really great. So importance about the connection between mind, body, spirit, starting where you are, just getting the better version of yourself every day and not trying to get anybody else's better version of anybody, right? Just keep yourself in focus.
Yeah, try to be your best self, set small goals that are attainable and achievable, and don't beat yourself up if you don't get out there and walk or run a mile one day. Maybe you're too busy. Just get out there the next day and start over, start where you're at that day, you know.
So. Yeah, do something.
Yeah, I think a lot of people start with these New Year's resolutions. You know, the gyms are always really packed in January, but by February, it already dies off again. And me, as a person who goes to the gym a lot to swim and do weights, I kind of get a little frustrated because the gym's really crowded during that month, you know, and I'm like, where are you guys the rest of the year? And then I actually get happier in February when it's less crowded and I can find a parking spot. But I mean, as somebody who's trying to promote fitness, I should encourage everybody to stay out there all year and, you know, deal with the extra people. But it's kind of nice when the gym's less crowded after all the people who give up on their New Year's resolutions disappear. And I wish they wouldn't, honestly, for their own selves. And, you know, just start over again in February. Don't wait again until a whole nother year.
Yeah, and pay another entire year of gym and just lose a month or two, which is crazy.
Yeah. They make a lot of money off the people who like don't show up. And the guy at my gym, he's like, yeah, 90% of our clients never show up.
That's the business, right?
Yeah, they're paying our business. So we love that they're paying for the memberships.
Exactly. And one of the things that we actually want to also mention here is the importance of consistency, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that go from 0 to 7 days, 2 hours per day, but, you know, like make a plan and stick to the plan. Like start with like 3 times running or whatever sports per week and then, you know, take it from there. But if you say I'm going to go 3 times, you go 3 times. And that's better than saying I go 7 times and then you go just 2 of them, right?
Yeah, definitely. Set something that's smart, attainable, realistic. You know, most people live really busy lives and work a lot of hours. So yeah, 3 times a week is reasonable. Yeah, you're thinking you're going to go 7 days times, you know, 7 days a week. I think for a lot of people, they think that and then they don't do it and then they just get depressed and kind of give up or whatever. So yeah, definitely set realistic goals, you know, and then if it drives you, you know, and 3 days a week gets easy and you feel like you can do more, then you can build the 4 or 5 if that's something that, you know, you desire and you want to keep, you know, improving and going longer or further or harder, whatever your goals are.
Yeah. And then you also mentioned the importance on keeping a log, right? It's writing down the training sessions that you have, what you did, how much you did, how long you ran, or how much weight you lifted, right? And I think that's really important.
Yeah, very important. I mean, I think for me, ever since 2009, I've kept a little notebook in my car and I write down every workout I do. And having gotten to triathlons, you know, I'd be like, okay, I swam, you know, 2,000 yards a day or I swam 4,000 yards a day. And I just get, you know, one line each page, you know, or 10 miles biking or 50 miles biking, whatever it was. And then I could go through and kind of see where I was at and be like, also for me to avoid burnout, I could see like, oh, look, you've done 3 hard weeks in a row. You should kind of do a recovery week. For people who train to do long distance stuff, you can't just go out there and grind all the time or you're going to burn out. So the general cycle for endurance athletes is kind of 3 hard weeks and then 1 recovery week, especially if you're training year round.
Yeah. And I think that's also important, whatever sports you do. You know, I know the weightlifting and fitness area, but also there you do these kind of macro cycles across several weeks. And then within the week, you have heavy days, you have lighter days, you have recovery days and so on. You can't just grind out 5 days a week on maximum power, maximum performance, even if you do muscle group splits or whatever, right? So cycle through. And learn from your mistakes as well, right? And that's why it's so important to keep a log as well.
Yeah, I think keeping a log is great because you know what you've been doing. You know when you need to maybe let up a little so your body can recover. You know when maybe you need to be pushing a little harder because you've been slacking off too much. It's just a thermometer or whatever to gauge where you're at.
Yeah, right. And the other thing is what I found is I had times when I was, you know, not keeping a log because I thought, you know, like I'm just training for fun. I don't need that, right? But then there is something missing, and that something missing for me at least is the self-accountability.
Yes.
If I keep a log, right, I write down every training, and then if there is no training written down on a particular day, I just wasn't training, right? And then when I go through, it's like, I should not train. I should have something in the log there, right? And that's kind of an additional motivation to go there so that you can actually maintain your training streak or whatever, right?
Yeah. I know some people are really into the streak. So, you know, I know some runners that want to do, you know, want to have this running streak every day. I know some guys that have it like going on 1,000 days where they at least ran 1 mile every day. Even on the days they don't feel like running, they'll get out there and at least do a mile, and they have these long streaks.
Yeah.
For me as a triathlete, I don't, you know, and having two knee surgeries, I take at least a couple of days off a week from running, just let the knees recover from the heavy impact. And then I cross train on those days. So.
Yeah, I think that's very important. I mean, I had times when I was training literally 7 days per week for 1 or 2 hours, right? And I cycled through like having light days and just days on the treadmill or whatever. But still, you know, like when I
call it the treadmill too. I love that. I hate the treadmill. I used to use it a lot, but you know, for speed work. But now it's just like I just want to be running outside with, you know, the fresh air.
Yeah, it's you know, just go there, because typically when I run outside, I run too fast. But if I want to keep my heart rate like in the 100s or 120s, because I'm pretty much untrained, I'm not the big endurance athlete. It's more like weightlifting my sports. But, you know, so I go on the treadmill and do an hour or whatever. But if I, in those times when I don't go to the gym like every day, I'm getting crazy. Right. So I really had to scale it back because it was not just a habit. It was becoming nearly an addiction. Right. And that's the other thing that you can get there, like being addicted to run or being addicted to work out. Right. Which is not the worst addiction you can have, admittingly. Yeah. But still.
My friends and family told me, you know, when I got sober and started doing this stuff, they're like, you know, we're glad you finally found a positive, healthy addiction besides, you know, the drugs and alcohol and the other things I was doing. So I think, and also for people who are serious about getting better at whatever their sport might be or whatever their fitness goals are, you kind of have to be a little obsessive because it helps you stay consistent, though, if you're kind of addicted or obsessive to it, then it'll keep you on, you know, however many days a week you want to stick to getting out there and working out, weightlifting, or whatever your sport is.
Yeah, I think it's part of those useful and healthy routines and habits that one can develop, because I think we all need routines and habits. They give us structure and they give us something we can hold upon, right?
Yeah.
And as there can be the detrimental habits and destructive habits, there's also the ones on the positive side that we need to then consciously nourish and develop, right?
Right. I totally agree.
Tim, when people want to know more about you and your book, you have a website, right?
Yes, it's ultratimdavis.com.
And the book, again, to remember, it's Tripolar, the story of a bipolar athlete. It's available on Amazon, right?
Yeah, it's available on Amazon, Apple Books, Barnes & Noble, Indie Books, a few other distributors. It's available in paperback, Kindle or ebook and audiobook. So I know for me, I like to listen to audiobooks when I'm out running or cycling for a long time. I kill two birds with one stone by listening to podcasts or audiobooks instead of just music the whole time. So
perfect. So we are going to put all those links into the show notes so that people can actually refer to and download from there.
Yeah.
So Tim, was a great time talking with you. Thanks a lot for having been here. Wish you all success for your future endeavors, including the Lake Tahoe in next September.
Yeah. That one scares me, but I always say if your dreams don't scare you, then you're not dreaming big enough. So
that's a good final quote. Thank you. Have a good time. Enjoy.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to you, Tim. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
This was Tim Davis, the man who went from drug and alcohol addiction into being a successful triathlete and ultra runner. To know more about Tim, head over to ultratimdavis.com and don't miss out on his book, Tripolar, the story of a bipolar triathlete, available on Amazon, Kindle, and paperback. As usual, the links and the book are going to be in the show notes. Thanks a lot for listening to The Considered Life. This means a lot to me, and there is much more to come in the next months, so stay tuned. Don't forget to share the podcast with your friends and anybody who you think can benefit. This would help me very much to reach a larger audience and hopefully help changing more lives to the better. Don't forget to leave a review on your favorite podcast platform, wherever you are listening to. And as usual, the transcript of this episode and the show notes are available on podcast.markkillian.com. See you next time. Be happy, be kind, and lead a considered life.